Welcome to Torah Nimecha Nach Yomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Lynn Kraft, and today we will be learning Melachim Aleph Perek Chaf Aleph. Achav decided that he wanted to purchase a vineyard from a man named Navot HaYisraeli, since it was right next to his palace and he wanted to expand his palace grounds by planting a garden on the land that was currently owned by Navot. Achav approached Navot with an offer, either to replace his current vineyard with an even better vineyard elsewhere, or to pay him for his current vineyard's value. But Navot refused to sell his vineyard to Achav. He explained that Hashem did not allow him to sell his vineyard to the king, since it was his nachala, his portion from his fathers. To clarify, there were two competing demands on Navot here. The king's demand for his land versus Hashem's demand that a family nachala always stay within the family. In fact, the halacha is that one may sell his land only when he's in dire financial straits. And even so, it's a mitzvah for a family member to redeem it and restore it to the family. If that doesn't happen, it's automatically returned to the original owner during Yovel. The reason for this halacha is that we need to always remember that the land is not ours, rather it's Hashem's, and therefore it's not ours to sell. Hashem entrusted the land to us, and unless we don't have a choice, we are to hold on to it. According to the Rambam, there's another halacha that a king may not take a citizen's land unless the nation is at war and has nothing to eat. And even then, the king must pay the citizen. Recall that when Achav asked Navot to buy his vineyard from him, it was not a time of war. Therefore, in the face of the two competing demands on Navot, one from the king and one from Hashem, it's clear that Hashem's demand must win out. In fact, Achav recognized this and didn't even protest or try to exercise his royal power when faced with Navot's refusal. Rather, he just went home depressed that he didn't get what he had wanted. He became so depressed, in fact, that he started sleeping all day and refused to eat anything. Interestingly, the same exact lashon of sar v'zaif is used here to describe Achav's depression, as was used in the previous parak to describe his despondent reaction to the Navi's rebuke, when the Navi told him that he would die as a punishment for letting Ben-Hadad go free. Perhaps the same lashon is used to connect these two episodes, demonstrating that his depressive symptoms became so intense due to the juxtaposition of these two statements that were both very difficult for him to bear. One, first the Navi's and then Navot's. Achav's wife Izebel, ever the doting wife, noticed that Achav was depressed and asked him what was wrong. Achav proceeded to tell her what happened, yet he made certain changes in his telling over of the story to her in Pasuk Vav from what we were originally told had happened in Pasuk Bet. When speaking to Navot in Pasuk Bet, Achav explained to him why he wanted to purchase his vineyard. His reasoning was because he wanted to make it into a garden for his palace. However, when retelling the story to Izebel in Pasuk Vav, Achav left out the reason he gave to Navot, excluding it from his recounting completely. Perhaps Achav decided to leave out this detail because just saying, "Give me your vineyard," without adding an explanation made him seem more demanding, as a king who is making demands without having to explain himself. And he wanted to appear more demanding to Izebel, perhaps to impress her with his power. Achav also switched the order in which he made his offers to Navot. When speaking to Navot in Pasuk Bet, Achav first offered him a different tract of land and subsequently offered money as an alternative. However, when retelling the story to Izebel in Pasuk Vav, he first mentioned his offer of money and only afterward mentioned his offer of land. Perhaps Achav decided to switch the order because he realized that Izebel didn't understand the value of land in Eretz Yisrael in terms of its being a nachalat avot. She really only understood the value of money. Therefore, mentioning it first made him appear more powerful again in her eyes. However, being that Navot was a member of Bnei Yisrael who appreciated the value of land in Eretz Yisrael much more than the value of money, when Achav was trying to convince him to sell, he made the greater offer first, the more valuable offer first, which was that of land in Eretz Yisrael. Finally, when Navot explained his refusal of Achav's request in Pasuk Gimel, he referred to Hashem's lack of agreement in the matter and to the inherent value of Nachalat Avot. However, when retelling the story to Izebel in Pasuk Vav, Achav left out Navot's explanation completely and told Izebel only that Navot refused his request. Perhaps Achav decided to leave out Navot's reasons for refusing to give him his vineyard because Izebel didn't share Navot's recognition of Hashem as the ultimate God and ruler, nor did she understand the value, as we said before, of Nachalat Avot. And so Navot's reasons would be meaningless to her. And perhaps they may even have fueled her frustration that Achav didn't insist on his rights as king to just forcibly take the vineyard from Navot. Which was why Izebel's response to her husband in Pasuk Zayin was, "Ata, ata, ta'aseh, melucha al Yisrael. you will now establish your reign upon Bnei Israel. Get up and eat and improve your spirits, and I will procure Nabot's vineyard for you." This demonstrates that Izebel didn't understand the Israelite view of monarchy at all. In Sidon, where she was from, kings had ultimate power. If they wanted something from one of their citizens, all they had to do was claim it and it would be theirs. If the citizen protested, they'd be executed. In other words, in Sidon, and in fact in all the nations in the ancient Near East, there was the institution of absolute monarchy. In a monarchy in which the king had absolute power and was beholden to no one and nothing, for there was no one more powerful than him. However, kings of Yisrael were subject to very different standards. Because we believe that Hashem ruled over them, they were subject to Hashem's laws, the kings were subject to Hashem's laws, just as the people were. In other words, the kingdom in Eretz Yisrael, whether Malchut Yehuda or Malchut Yisrael, was not an absolute monarchy, but rather what we call today a constitutional monarchy, a monarchy which is beholden to a higher set of laws. In our case, the Torah, Hashem's laws. And among Hashem's laws were those that made sure that the kings of Bnei Israel did not wield too much power over their people. Specifically in terms of land, the people had rights over the king. And that's why even Izebel couldn't just execute Nabot in order to get his vineyard. Rather, she was compelled, even though she was queen, to devise an entire plan in which she hired false witnesses and framed Nabot for having committed a sin worthy of execution, cursing Hashem and the king. Nabot was falsely convicted and was stoned to death as a consequence. Izebel could only succeed in getting Nabot out of the way through the accepted justice system of Klal Yisrael. An incredible phenomenon, considering that at this time everyone in Malchut Yisrael worshipped Avodah Zarah. However, it seems that their justice system was still in place, and their conception of their kingdom as a constitutional monarchy held a lot of weight as well. As soon as Izebel heard the news that Nabot was taken care of, she told Ahav to get out of bed in order to inherit Nabot's vineyard because he was no longer alive. As soon as Ahav heard that Nabot had died, he got up out of bed and claimed Nabot's vineyard for himself. And yet, when Eliyahu came to rebuke Ahav for what had transpired, he didn't blame Izebel for having murdered Nabot. Rather, he blamed Ahav for having murdered Nabot. At first glance, this doesn't seem fair at all. Ahav had no idea what was happening. Izebel had used Ahav's signet ring to sign away on the plan, while Ahav was lying in bed depressed. Ahav only found out what had been done later after Nabot had already been killed. So how could it be Ahav's fault? However, we have to realize that the only reason why Izebel was able to get away with this murder in the first place was because of the kind of relationship she had with Ahav and the amount of power he had given her within the kingdom. It was because of Ahav that Izebel wielded the influence that she did. In fact, one of the king's major responsibilities to the nation was to uphold the values of Tzedek and Mishpat in his kingdom. In fact, if we recall, Shlomo had asked for his chachma, for his wisdom, in order to do just that. The fact that Nabot's murder could have been arranged so easily by Izebel demonstrates that Ahav failed in this mandate. Additionally, it's important to note two things about the interactions between Ahav and Izebel. First, before Izebel framed Nabot and had him murdered, and then afterwards. In Pasuk Zion, just after Izebel told Ahav that he would now establish his reign upon Bnei Yisrael, Ata Ata Ta'asem Melucha Al Yisrael, she continued to encourage him to eat and improve his mood, since she said, Ani atein lecha et kerem Nabot ha-Yisraeli, I will give you Nabot's vineyard. But Ahav didn't ask Izebel what her plan was to make sure that it was ethical or halachically acceptable. He didn't respond to her statement at all. Izebel understood this to be a silent acquiescence with whatever it was she chose to do, and proceeded with her decidedly unethical and halachically unacceptable plan. Hashem apparently understood Ahav's silence in the same way, and therefore Eliyahu implicated him in Nabot's murder. Furthermore, after the plot in Pasuk Tet Zayin, just after Izebel told Ahav that Nabot had died, Ahav didn't even bother asking her how or why Nabot had died. He just went straight to the vineyard to claim it as his own. This implies that Ahav didn't really care how Nabot died. He only cared about getting his vineyard. This teaches us an important lesson about the responsibility of national leaders. The king is responsible for everything that happens in his kingdom and can never absolve himself by saying, but I didn't know. The king sets the tone for the entire kingdom, and if there is any wrongdoing anywhere in the kingdom, he is ultimately the one responsible for it. Rabbi Chaim Jachter makes an even bolder suggestion. proposing that perhaps Ahav intentionally provoked Isabel to take action against Navot. Rabbi Jachter suggests that Ahav actually feigned his upset with Navot and his subsequent depression in order to manipulate Isabel into taking action herself, so that if the plan backfired, he would be able to claim innocence. Rabbi Jachter compares this to the opinion in the Gemara Megillah Daf Yudalet Amud Aleph that Ahasuerus was not manipulated by Haman, but that it was Ahasuerus who manipulated Haman so that Haman would be the one blamed for annihilating the Jews, and Ahasuerus would be able to claim innocence if the plan backfired. Rabbi Jachter notes that there are several parallels, in fact, between the Navot story and the Purim story. In both, a powerful leader reacted with exaggerated upset when rebuffed by a minor personality. In both, missives of annihilation of a people or one person were sent out. But in both, they were only sent out after they were signed by the king's signet ring. Eliyahu then proceeded to inform Ahav of his impending punishments. He will die an unnatural death, just like Navot did, and his blood will be lapped up by dogs, just like Navot's blood was. This is a mida keneged mida punishment, a measure for measure punishment. Ahav will also lose his dynasty, just like Yeravam ben Nevat and Baasha ben Achiah had lost theirs. And Isabel will be punished for this sin as well, in that she will be killed by dogs. This is din, justice. Perhaps this is why Hashem called upon Eliyahu to deliver this nevuah even after he had resigned from his post of Navi. Because interacting with Bnei Yisrael with Rachamim, he couldn't really do. But he could, and even desired to, deliver punishment to Ahav for all the sins he had committed. That's what he had wanted to do the whole time. However, upon hearing his punishment, Ahav responded with tearing his clothing, wearing sackcloth, and fasting. In other words, Ahav did tshuva. And what's perhaps even more surprising is that Hashem accepted his tshuva, demonstrating that Ahav must have sincerely regretted what he had done, because otherwise Hashem would not have accepted his tshuva. So Hashem sent Eliyahu back to Ahav to tell him that because of his tshuva, his dynasty would not end with his own death, but rather with his son's death. In other words, Hashem will delay his anger, using the midah of the Yud Gimel Midot HaRachamim, the 13 attributes of mercy, called Erech Apayim, which means that Hashem is slow to anger. In other words, he will delay punishment and not punish immediately. What an important lesson for us in how Hashem employs Rachamim Badin, mercy with injustice. This lesson was likely not just for us to learn, but also for Eliyahu, the bearer of this nevuah, to learn. Because yes, Baruch Hashem, tshuva does change things for the better. Thank you for studying together Le'iloi Nishmat, Malka Esther Batzvi Yosef.